You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
Trumpty Dumpty wanted a crown. Trumpty Dumpty wanted a crown to make certain he never would have to step down. He wanted a robe made of ermine and velvet. The Constitution, he wanted to shelve it. With impeachment awash, his ambition had grown. He wanted an orb, a scepter, a throne, 6 royal palaces, 6 royal carriages, a church dispensation for 6 royal marriages, courtiers installed on his own Supreme Court, and royal beheadings, if only for sport. He craved the occasional royal procession and, gasp, the eventual royal succession. Trumpty Dumpty gets his way, unless the public has something to say. If we let him have all of his favorite things, we'll have to endure the divine right of kings.
That was John Lithgow reading the title poem from his new book, Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown, Verses from a Despotic Age. It's a sequel to his first book of poems, Dumpty, The Age of Trump in Verse, which became a New York Times bestseller and the perfect vehicle for the erudite star of film, television, and stage to take down Donald Trump and his cronies through witty rhyme and verse. And today, I'm happy to welcome John Lithgow on the podcast to share some of his favorite poems from the book, why he's generally avoided politics in public, and how a performance of Gilbert and Sullivan's most famous song inspired him to find his political voice through poetry. He reveals that he originally wanted to go into art instead of acting, how his poetry books have returned him to his childhood love of drawing, and why the motley cast of characters around Donald Trump serve as an endless inspiration for his humorous illustrations. We also discuss his magnificent turns as Roger Ailes and Winston Churchill, as well as in HBO's new series Perry Mason, how this classically trained actor was convinced to play an alien on the hit sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, and how Twilight Zone, the movie, has made him every flight attendant's favorite star. On the lighter side, we talk about his series of books and albums for children, and on the darker side, we get into his poem about the president's deadly mishandling of the coronavirus nightmare. Plus, whether or not he might one day want to play Trumpty Dumpty himself. Coming up with the delightful John Lithgow in just a moment. John Lithgow is a prolific actor with 2 Tonys, 6 Emmys, 2 Golden Globes, and 2 Oscar nominations. He has starred in the hit series Third Rock from the Sun, Dexter, The Crown, and most recently in HBO's Perry Mason, as well as in critically acclaimed films such as The World According to Garp, Terms of Endearment, Bombshell, and Late Night. Lithgow has appeared on Broadway 25 times and in England with both the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre. He's written 9 children's books, and his recordings for kids have earned him 4 Grammy nominations. Dumpty, his book of politically charged poetry, was a New York Times bestseller, and now he's following it up with Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown, Verses for a Despotic Age, And he's also getting close to eclipsing Tyler Perry for on-screen appearances in a fat suit. John Lithgow, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I feel welcome. This is great.
Well, first, I got to tell you, I really loved you and Perry Mason. What a great performance you gave.
Thank you. Thank you so much. How sad that I only got to be in four episodes. It was a wonderful gig.
Really? Only four of those episodes? Because you made a big impact, if so. Wow. Now, well, you didn't have to wear any padding for that, right?
No padding, no padding, only my own padding.
Nice.
I made a big impact because that's what they hired me for.
Yeah. it was great, but it wasn't anything that I expected because, you know, I'm not old enough to remember the old series, but I'm old enough to remember the Perry Mason specials that they did back in the 80s. And I suppose that for a lot of people now, they're probably coming to this with fresh eyes because they don't have any memory of the old Raymond Burr series.
Yeah, but for the people who do remember Perry Mason and grew up with it, it was almost the intention of Rollin Jones and Ron Fitzgerald, these great writers, and Tim Van Patten, who executive produced it, to just transgress everybody's expectations, make it almost as different as possible. Although it's much more loyal to the original writing of Earl Stanley Gardner. He set all these stories in sort of crime noir 1930s Los Angeles. So
that must be fun to do 30s LA noir and all those great locations around town.
Yes.
Yeah.
I finally got to see my city, you know. they had to work hard to find great big locations where it looks like 1931.
Yeah, and I also have to tell you that I just discovered your children's albums. Our daughter is only seven months old, but she might be a little young for this, but Daddy loves it because
these are my people. Yeah, I'm like a Jesuit. I get them while they're young.
Yeah, you know? I love it because I'm not big on Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and that sort of thing. These are the kind of songs that I sing to her at night. I sing the classics from the Great American Songbook, quirky little tunes from the 20s, you know, Swinging on a Star and all that.
Yeah. I'm delighted to hear this. I haven't really been doing much singing for kids in the last few years, but there was about a 10-year period there where I was doing it a lot and singing full concerts at Carnegie Hall with big orchestras.
Wow.
It was floating under the radar, you know. I was the only people who knew about this were 5-year-old children and their parents, and all of them have outgrown me and forgotten all about it. So it's wonderful to hear from you that someone's listening to my albums.
Yeah,
that is particularly that first one, Singing in the Bathtub. It's just a great all those great old Tin Pan Alley songs retooled for children.
Oh, yeah. And she's a big Jimmy Durante fan. So, you know, she really loves the Inka Dinka Doo.
yeah. That's right. I actually sang a Jimmy Durante song.
It's interesting because you have your hand in so many different pies besides acting. Uh-huh. It must be kind of fun to be John Lithgow. I mean, if you feel like recording a kid's album, you do it. If you want to do a ballet, you do a ballet. Poetry, children's books, illustrator.
You've done all your homework. Yes, indeed. I have soloed with the New York City Ballet. Not many people know that. Yes, it is. They are wonderfully fun projects. I early on established myself as someone who does lots of things. And if you give me the chance, if you give me the opportunity, I'll seize it. As a result, I've just been able to fly off in all these directions. Most recently, we've made this wonderful series of 21 little videos for the release of the book we're going to talk about. And I've corralled all these fabulous friends of mine, had them all sort of film themselves at home reciting my poems. And we've engaged this, my friend Tim Van Patten. He engaged this wonderful group of guys who created Triptych Productions. And they've produced these in which they actually animate my drawings with me helping them out. So I bought myself a light box and tracing paper, and I've begun my career as a kind of poor man's animator. I feel like Walt Disney in 1931.
Yeah, yeah, I saw a few of the videos. They're just terrific.
Oh, you did?
You got an amazing group of people, both from entertainment and politics, to participate. Can you tell us some names involved?
Oh, I'm a big name dropper from way back.
Okay.
We have Alan Alda and Annette Bening and Glenn Close and Meryl Streep in one of the very first. But then Samuel Jackson and Whoopi Goldberg and Steve Buscemi and Edie Falco and Joseph Gordon-Levitt and myself. and then we sprinkled in Senator John Tester, the epidemiologist Laurie Garrett, James Carville,
and even
the Lincoln Project's Steve Schmidt.
Oh yeah,
just to give a real snap of politics to it.
Yeah,
as if it weren't political enough.
Now, did they mostly do it as a favor to you as a friend, or because they were political and they wanted to speak out against Trump, or a little bit of both?
I think it was a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. Not all of them were friends of mine. I've never even met James Carville, and he said yes in a heartbeat. And he's hilarious, absolutely wonderful in them.
Yes.
And I think it's kind of like what we were just talking about. It was such an unlikely thing to be asked to do. They just thought, well, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Tester had to run the idea by the Senate Ethics Committee,
which I thought
was just delightful. But they said, yeah, sure, fine. I mean, there's plenty of unethical behavior these days. This hardly rates.
For sure. Yeah, you do so many different types of projects, and you really do cross generations from the children's book on up. I imagine that every generation has a different reference for you as well. You know, the kids know your songs. My parents' generation probably thinks of Terms of Endearment. And for me particularly, I think the first movie I remember you from was the Twilight Zone movie. And what was it? Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, huh?
Yes, my pride and joy. It's made me the patron saint for flight attendants. I wish I had a nickel for every Twilight Zone joke they've told me.
Oh, really?
So,
I saw it when I was still a kid, and I still got chills for years whenever I would sit over the wing of a plane.
sure. We're directed by none other than George Miller.
Right.
Right back in his Road Warrior days.
It must be fun to hear what performances stand out with your fans. What do you get the most, Third Rock or what?
I would say probably, it usually depends on what I've done recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, we actors, we're accustomed to this. Everything we do has a sell-by date. It has traditionally been Third Rock from the Sun because that was 6 years of, you know, sitcom in your living room. But recently it's been The Crown, Winston Churchill in The Crown, and Roger Ailes in Bombshell, and Perry Mason. You know, stuff that's just happened and is right in the front of people's minds. But it's wonderful to hear something like when you said about my kids' albums, or someone telling me that they loved me in Don Quixote, a film I did for TNT way back in 1999.
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, almost nobody does.
Oh, really?
So it's nice when it just sort of pops out of the blue.
Yeah. So many great performances.
I don't know. You just have to get used to the fact that what you do is written on water. Mm. Eventually, it'll be forgotten. I remember a day working on Third Rock where we were all talking about old movies, and we dropped the name Cary Grant, and Joey Gordon-Levitt at age 15 said, who is Cary Grant? And all of us, like, our hearts just sank. It's like it all gets forgotten.
Yeah, not by me. I remember a lot, not just the big ones, but the smaller ones, like when you did FDR in the miniseries and stuff like that.
Oh, my God. Now, that I haven't heard for a long time.
Yeah, you were a great FDR. And I was a big fan of Third Rock. But I'll tell you, the thing that I always wanted to know is, what was your initial reaction when, I guess it would have been Marcy Carsey and Tom Warner pitched that to you? Here you are, a guy who studied at Harvard and the London Academy, does Shakespeare, you know, this show about a family of aliens. What was that initial reaction?
Well, it was a very funny story. The creators of the show for Tom and Marcy were Bonnie and Terry Turner,
mm-hmm.
a married couple, comedy writers, and they were good friends of mine. They had been on the writing staff of SNL when I hosted it a few times in the 1980s.
Oh, yeah.
And they, my agent called me and said, your friends, Bonnie and Terry Turner, would love to have breakfast with you. And I thought, oh, great, I would love to see Bonnie and Terry, thinking it was a social occasion. That's how stupid I am. And off I went to the Four Seasons restaurant for breakfast, and there were Bonnie and Terry and Tom and Marcy and Karen Mondebach. It was a whole the whole phalanx of Carsey Werner. And I thought, oh, no, I've been completely ambushed. This is a sitcom pitch. And at that time in my life, I was very snobbish about episodic TV. I hadn't even considered it. I was sort of riding high my first few years in the movies. And so I thought, you know, it came to Terry to pitch Third Rock from the Sun to me. And the first sentence out of his mouth was, well, it's about these four aliens. And I thought, oh, how am I going to say no to this as graciously as I can and get out of here? And within 5 minutes, they'd persuaded me to do it. I mean, it was that great a premise. Besides which, I looked around the table and I thought, these are just wonderful people.
A lot of talent.
What have I been holding out for? I would love to work with these people. And honestly, they persuaded me in no time. And it changed everything. I mean, I think I was perceived that the way you just described me as this sort of lofty New York stage actor with a background in Shakespeare. And this just took that and threw it into a blender. I was perceived completely differently. And I just had a wonderful time. I mean, it was 6 years of flat-out laughter.
It's really hard to typecast you nowadays.
Well, let them try.
Yeah.
You know, although I am getting offered an awful lot of old, fat, bald white men.
Roger Ailes, Churchill.
That seems, yeah.
Now, before we get to the book, I know that you come from a theatrical family. Your mom was an actress and your dad was a producer and director. Were you always sort of predestined for a life in the theater and film? Or did you have other interests?
I think I probably was predestined. But growing up, it's not what I intended to do at all. I wanted to be an artist.
Oh, really?
From a very young age. As the earliest I ever remember answering the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? It was always, I'm going to be an artist.
Okay.
And I was quite serious about it until I finally got to college. I mean, I did a huge amount of acting as a kid for my dad. He produced Shakespeare festivals. So I was in 4 and 5 different Shakespeare plays every summer in all the kid parts, or by the time I was a teenager, I was playing all those kind of utility comics in Shakespeare. So I was a very seasoned and experienced young actor, arrived at college and fell in with the theater gang, and I was 5 times better than anybody else. And so I think I was foredoomed.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Well, things have sort of come full circle, I guess, because with this new book and the previous book, Dumpty, you do both the poetry and the illustrations. And I want to remind people the title. It's Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown, Verses for a Despotic Age.
I have it right here. Funny you should mention.
Great so, illustration.
Yes, you see, I've done book tours before.
I have to tell you, I love the title because it does seem like he's growing more despotic by the day. I actually find myself longing for the days when I was just outraged that he wanted to hang out with dictators. But
yes.
Now,
isn't it amazing? I mean, I thought of the first poem, and that's where the title came from. And I did think that was a great thread to go through the book, but I had no idea how perfect that title would be. And he's become more and more frantic, which is what mad kings do. So it's just, now it's just spot on, and the timing is perfect. And I cannot take any credit for that. He's the one who's cooperated with me. Donald Trump is my collaborator.
Yeah, I mean, you're refusing to commit to a peaceful transition and, you know, talking about running for a third term, wanting to pass on the president down to his kids, you know, as some kind of divine right.
It's all governing by edict. Mm-hmm. That's all he accomplishes, if you can call them accomplishments, are through executive orders, which is what kings do. You know, Congress be damned.
Gosh. And I understand that Dumpty was born out of a performance that you gave at a fundraiser for the Public Theater in New York. Can you tell us how that inspired your first book, Dumpty, and now this one?
Yeah, you're remarkable. You really have done all your homework.
I try. I
was asked to perform for they have a yearly gala at the outdoor Delacorte Theater for 1,800 people. And they were, this particular year, I think it was 2017, they were doing a tribute to all the musical theater that the Public Theater had created.
Okay.
Hair, Chorus Line, Hamilton, Fun Home. And they asked me to sing the Major General's song from the Pirates of Penzance because they'd had a great hit with that in the 1970s. And I said yes, but I suggested that I rewrite the third verse and perform it in the full costume and makeup of Michael T. Flynn, and perform it as, I am the very model of an ex-lieutenant general, etc. And that's what I did, and it absolutely killed. The last verse I wrote was, when President Obama made me head of all things clandestine, he realized he'd brought to life a governmental Frankenstein. But then I made a killing in a case of public pillory by shouting, lock her up, in my harangue opposing Hillary. Then I became the National Security Advisory until I let the crafty Russian Secret Service hire me. Now I become the target of a special counsel crime report, a fate I share with Donald Jr. and with Manafort.
That is brilliant.
And it went on like that. And it absolutely stopped the show. It's like it was the only flat-out comedy bit. And I mean, I just listened to the audience roar with laughter. And this was in the sixth month of the Donald Trump presidency. And Michael Flynn had screwed the pooch in the first week, you know. So it's like everybody was just waiting for a political statement. And it was, of course, it was a New York liberal crowd, the Public Theater gang. Now, that's all backstory. It was a year later when my literary agent, a wonderful agent named David Kuhn, he sat me down and he said, okay, I've been your agent for 3 years now and you haven't written a thing. You've got to write a book. And we thrashed around for ideas. And in the course of that conversation, I said, well, wait a minute. I did write this verse and I sang what I just sang to you. And it's like the sun, he was like an orchid opening up in the sun. As he listened to this, he literally said, there's your book. And that was the birth of Dumpty.
Wow.
You know, it had never occurred to me to write political satire. I've never been that overtly political. I mean, I have strong political convictions, which I tend to keep to myself. But this was the perfect way to sort of go public. Here again, I give all credit to Donald Trump. His behavior and his governance have sort of yanked me into the public arena.
Yeah.
I'm an entertainer. What better way to express my outrage than by entertaining people?
Absolutely.
So that's the essence of the book.
Yeah. I have to give you credit. You're a better man than me because I have tried a million times to sing the Major General's song and to sing it at an appropriately fast tempo because otherwise what's the point? And I always get tripped up at binomial theorem for some reason.
Oh, you are good. You are good.
I'm not, though. I can't make it for the first verse.
Or that crazy rhyme about satyrgy. There never was a general who could satyrgy. Gilbert and Sullivan there. they're beyond all of us.
Yes, truly. Right. Now, did you ever have any trepidation when you first set out to write a book of poetry about Donald Trump? You mentioned that you weren't a particularly political guy until now.
Well, I wanted to be strategic and ingenious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted it to be something completely original. My first impulse, first of all, I thought that like the Major General song, I would do parody versions of standard songs, mm-hmm. kind of in the mode of Randy Rainbow, something that he does completely brilliantly. But I sort of ran out of gas after the third or fourth try. And I felt like I was kind of repeating the joke. And I also was troubled by the fact that I would have probably, if I was ever going to perform this, I would have to pay royalties for them. Right. It got very complicated. And here again, David Kuhn stepped into the fray and he said, liberate yourself. Just try writing them just as poems. Mm-hmm. And there again, that was the beginning of it all. I mean, it only sort of occurred to me later that my whole life I'd been writing poems.
Really?
Sort of occasional sassy verses, like at the end, like at the closing night cast party of a Broadway play, a poem in which I would rhyme everybody's name. Or I've given two prep school commencement speeches where there was a graduating class of 30 or 40 kids, and I did rhyming poem in which I used the name of every one of the kids and phoned the college dean just a week before so that everything I wrote was very, very current. All these little scandals attached to each student. And these were such successes. That and the fact that I've written 9 rhyming children's books. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. I guess I had much more of a background than I realized as a doggerel poet. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a house where Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, all of these wonderful A.A. Milne, the poems for kids, a lot of them out of England, that my folks would read to me. And interestingly, an old friend of my older sister, whom I had known when I was a kid, although she was my sister's best friend, she sent me a little Xerox of her autograph book from 1955, where my sister had signed with a little message, and I signed too. 1955 means that I was 9 years old, and I wrote, "Dear Jessica, Cokes in bottles, jellies in jars, faces like yours come from Mars. Love, John Lithgow." So perhaps that was the very beginning of my career as a poet.
Yeah.
I'd long since forgotten this, of course.
And I love that many of these are fresh takes on well-known nursery rhymes. I found that so perfectly fitting because so many of the classic Mother Goose rhymes began as political satire with some kind of political message, like Mary, Mary, Quite Contrary is all about Queen Mary the First restoring Roman Catholicism to England, or Baba Black Sheep is protesting wool taxes. You're part of a grand tradition here, aren't you?
You know a lot more than I. There's a book in you, sir.
I hope so. But, well, you set me up with your agent when I come up with it then.
Well, particularly in the first book, where I sort of tapped out all the sources for parody. Mm-hmm. I wrote an Owl and the Pussycat poem about Trump and Kim Jong-un. I wrote The Walrus and the Carpenter about John Bolton and Vladimir Putin. I wrote Rub-a-Dub-Dub, 3 Men in a Tub, about all the medical men, Bornstein, Ronnie Jackson, and Tom Price. But I sort of tapped those out. The only ones left in the second book are 3 sort of trilogy of Trumpty Dumpty poems. Mm-hmm.
And it's so fitting to mock this administration with wit and rhyme, because what little humor that Donald Trump has is so crude and so base. He has the vocabulary of a 3-year-old at best. He couldn't tell a joke to save his life. I have to think most of these would go right over his head, wouldn't they?
Yeah, although it's a sad truism that you have to always consider the audience. Mm-hmm. Trump gets a much, much bigger response or his crude buffoonery in his rallies than I will ever get on a Broadway stage.
Yeah, I remember in the intro to your first book, Dumpty, you actually addressed Trump's supporters, tried to make an appeal to them. Not in the second book, though. Have you? Is that a lost cause at this point?
It simply doesn't take. I'm sure none of them ever read my little address to them. I always say, I hope to sell lots and lots of books to Democrats, but I want to sell lots of them to Republicans too, because they're all going to want to burn them, but they have to buy them first. On the other hand, I do have a little section of heroes, which include plenty of Republicans. Almost in spite of myself, I do believe I write with a certain empathy for Donald Trump himself. If you read some of those poems, there's a poem in the first book called 7 Days in November about the appalling week following his losses in the 2018 midterm, in which he behaved so weirdly. That was when he refused to go to that memorial service in France because it was raining and he was worried about his hair. And it's all mocking him, of course, and taking him down to the best of my ability, but it also pities him. I mean, I do believe he's a completely pitiable figure. And as an actor, I'm just very interested in that side of villains. What is sad and insecure about them? I'm in the empathy business.
Yeah. I had David K. Johnston on a couple of times, who's written several books about Trump and followed him for the New York Times for 30 years. And I remember he said to me, "Be glad you're not Donald Trump, because he is a miserable, miserable human being." And I believe it.
Absolutely.
He's not happy.
And his behavior these days is out of pure terror of not being president, because when he's not being president, he's completely unprotected, and he's going to be so punished by a whole life of appalling behavior and crime.
Right.
And it makes it so easy to see why he will try absolutely anything, including suborning an entire election, something that no one has ever dreamed a president, an incumbent president, would ever dare to do.
Yeah, just like Putin or any other dictator. It's that same fear. Once you're out of power, you're vulnerable.
In such a panic. It's what Winston Churchill said about riding the tiger. Don't get off. Yeah. You can ride a tiger, but do not climb off. Which is kind of, as you know, in my book, there's a riding the tiger allegory in a long, long poem about the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you don't just focus on Donald Trump, but you also write about this vast, bizarre rogues gallery around him. And some of these guys are straight out of central casting, to borrow Trump's favorite line. You got Roger Stone, who's like a Dick Tracy villain. Manafort, he's such a dandy that even Trump used to call him Thurston Howell III. That must make it a lot of fun for a poet, but especially as an illustrator.
Well, I was going to mention this earlier, that when I set out to write them, I was not going to write about Trump at all. Oh. I was going to leave him out and just write about the crazy people in his orbit. One reason was I thought that was kind of a cool strategy for getting at Trump through other people. But I also thought it was the ultimate insult to Donald Trump to leave him out.
Absolutely.
But as I proceeded, these events kept happening, which you just absolutely had to address, like the whole cemetery in France. You just couldn't not write about that, and you can't write about that without writing about Trump. At which point, it became half about Trump and half about all the satellites in his orbit.
Mm-hmm.
And, which, in fact, is about Trump.
Yeah. And one of those who sort of used to be in his orbit was Roger Ailes, who you played in Bombshell. Great performance, by
the way.
I wonder if that role gave you any insight into the right wing and what's going on right now.
I don't know. I'm often asked questions like that about what did you learn from this? And I tend not to learn much. I just play the part.
Yeah.
And In the best of cases, other people learn from my performance. Certainly, acting in The Crown, and I give all credit to Peter Morgan, who wrote that brilliant series. It told you so much more about the royal family and about England in those decades, but also about Churchill. Much more than you knew. Who knew anything about the Big Smoke in 1952? That appalling climate event.
Yeah. And now we're living it here in L.A.
Yeah. That's the other thing about my book. Every one of my sassy poems, you can read the poem and you may not even be familiar about the subject of the poem, like who really knows who John McEntee is? Or Jim Jordan, unless
or
you're
Elliot Broidy,
or Elliot Broidy, or Ronnie Jackson. Yeah. In every case, I write the poem, but it's accompanied by a very deadpan little paragraph of information, mm-hmm. which simply informs people and reminds people. I mean, to me, the power of these books, if they have any power and impact, it's just the conflation of all these different people, putting them all in a single book, mm-hmm. a single very short book where you read through and you're so struck by how many scoundrels there are in this administration and how many appalling events. You put them all together and it's just kind of astonishing. We're in a news cycle where there's a new dreadful event every day, but boy, you put together like 30 or 40 of those events in one 120-page book, and it almost makes you want to vomit. Mm-hmm. That's my greatest aspiration.
Yeah. but it also runs the risk of normalizing all of this activity when it just comes at you like a fire hose.
Yeah.
But there's no denying the coronavirus. I think that is his greatest failing by far. And you address it in the book. That must have been interesting when you delve into dark stuff like that. Is it hard to write humorous satire about something that's, for once, is, you know, it's something that's actually still happening when it's published. We're still grappling with this.
You know, I'm tempted to read you a poem.
Please.
In order to answer that question. it is surprisingly easy. You know, it's interesting. I said yes to writing this book in last December. Just on the eve of the impeachment proceedings, and I knew that they were coming, and I knew that that would be a big subject. But who knew that there would be coronavirus, mm-hmm. not to mention the economy collapsing and the Black Lives Matter activism? All those things, there I was, writing day by day in real time. The tough thing is waiting around for a little hook. I'm sure it's like a rock musician trying to figure out a hook for a new song. Once you get the hook, things can come very easy. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how am I going to write about the coronavirus? Well, I thought of the image of Nero fiddling while Rome burned as a portrait of Trump just ignoring an appalling catastrophe. And I imagined him as a cook. And I wrote a poem called Recipe for Disaster. And I thought of writing a poem using the kind of prose of a cooking recipe, of a cookbook. And once I got that idea, it came in no time. And I'll read it for you.
Please.
And it's, believe me, it's the darkest poem in the book. So fasten your seatbelt. But here's the illustration for it.
I love that. Your illustrations are great.
It's Trump as a cook. As a chef, actually, and in the background, there's Rome burning.
Yeah,
it's all the frontline medical people taking care of their gurneys. It's called Recipe for Disaster, and just think of the last time you read from a cookbook. Try a viral new cuisine, COVID-19. Offer it to each civilian, 300 million. It's quick and easy to prepare microbial fare. First, preheat an anxious nation with misinformation. Take what others' leaders tried and set aside. place the 50 sovereign states on separate plates. So confusion and distrust make your crust. Insist on sycophantic praise, whip your glaze. Stir the pot for all to see on live TV. Add DeSantis, simmer low. Cuomo, no. Pound Jay Inslee, call him snake, then pre-bake. Claim it's Gretchen Whitmer's fault. Pinch of salt. If the kitchen is a mess, slam the press. If the pastry comes unstuck, pass the buck. Our supplies arriving late, blame the state. Shuck all science-based advice, puree twice. If the stock exchange careens, boil your greens. For a dash of ignorance, add Mike Pence. Use your clueless son-in-law for the slaw. Slash the funds for WHO, knead the dough. Add some spice to this fiasco with Tabasco. Once you learn how it can kill, throw in dill. When 100,000 die, bake your pie. When at last the horror's done, claim you won. Takes no time at all to master national disaster.
Wow. Wow. I laugh, but that is some biting satire there.
Yes. Well, it's a funny poem about a completely appalling subject, which just cannot go unaddressed in this book.
Absolutely.
So, and there's good a couple of them. There's another poem that's called Requiem Scored for Kazoo, and a long poem called A Pandemic's a Terrible Thing to Waste.
Wow.
Which is about all the title. Things that Trump has gone ahead and done. Mm-hmm. On usually announced late on a Friday night in the middle of a coronavirus epidemic so that nobody will quite pay attention, that he's fired 5 inspector generals so to the point where there's practically no one left to investigate him. A pandemic's a terrible thing to waste. Wow. Now, that's a funny poem, but it's as dark as it gets.
It boggles the mind, absolutely. Now, I'm curious, have you heard from any of the subjects of your poems, maybe even by 6 degrees of separation or something?
It's funny. I did Morning Joe just this morning.
Oh, yeah?
And just before they signed off, I said, oh, by the way, it was Willie Geist was interviewing me. But I said, by the way, I name-checked Joe Scarborough in one of the poems.
Right, yes.
Did you see this?
Yes.
And Joe, who was off camera, completely freaked out. And I said, don't worry, Joe, you come off fine. Because he's mentioned in McCarthy's Lullaby.
Oh, right, right. Oh, I love that one. Yeah.
If your polls are getting low, implicate Joe Scarborough. That's Joe McCarthy's lullaby.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. That's one of the ones that I marked, actually, that one.
That's one of my favorites, too. Now, that you asked if it's hard to write about these. I got the idea for that in the shower at about 8:30 in the morning, and it was such a cool idea. You know, it had struck me that nobody is mentioning Joe McCarthy when everything Trump does is pure McCarthy by way of Roy M. Cohn.
Exactly.
And I thought, I know, I'll have Joe McCarthy rocking Trump in a rocking chair and singing him a lullaby. And by 11 o'clock, I had finished the poem and the illustration. I mean, that is by far the quickest poem in the entire book.
Yeah.
And it's not a short poem.
It's amazing how inspiration comes in the shower so many times. Before we go, I just have to ask you one more question. Having played far better leaders like Churchill and FDR, would you ever want to play Donald Trump on film and TV? I mean, you've already got the fat suit, so that's one thing.
Well, it's very interesting you should ask. I did play Trump on this unique live stream of the Mueller report last spring. Mm-hmm. I was Donald Trump and Kevin Kline was Bob Mueller and Jason Alexander was Chris Christie. It was quite a wonderful, strange event, but it was just tossed together. Since then, I have been asked to play Donald Trump. And I couldn't quite do it because I was shooting something else. But I try to do everything, but I can't.
Yeah, not enough time in the day for sure. But man, you sure do crowd a lot in there.
Yeah.
Well, again, the book is just delightful. It's called Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown, Verses for a Despotic Age. John Lithgow, what a fun time you are. Thank you for joining me.
It was just great. Thank you so much. You made this wonderful. You're really, really good at this.
Thank you. And you're good at everything. So.
Oh, no, I wish that were true. At almost everything, I'm a very good actor.
Well said. Thanks again to the wonderful John Lithgow for coming on the show. Order his new book, Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown, Verses for a Despotic Age, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Also be sure to check out some of the video readings of Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown on YouTube and follow John on Twitter at John Lithgow. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.